Hey, Doc Eisenberg, how are we doing? Nicole
I'm good.
Eisenberg,
How are you?
Riverside.
Can you
Oh,
hear me okay?
yeah. Can you close out your Riverside? It looks like I'm getting some feedback that you have Riverside open on another tab, the podcast. I think it needs just one open.
Here. It's showing two still. Is
Wait, you X'd them out.
that better?
Notification's gone. I think we are all set. How you doing?
I'm good. And yourself?
Good. Great. Today, yeah, great.
How's the weather there in New York? Yeah.
Yesterday was like brittle because it was super windy, and you get all
Yeah.
these little cracks and everything in between your skin. And
Yes. Well,
how are you
your
doing?
weather has invaded us down here in Tennessee. We got an inch or two of snow today, so
You did.
we did.
You're in Knoxville, right?
I'm in Knoxville, Tennessee. Yeah. Honestly, I used to make fun of Southern people for not being able to tolerate or put up with bad weather, but now that I've lived here a while, we actually can't drive in the snow, and there are no facility or no plow truck, trucks to plow. There's no salt. There's no boulders to go off on the side of the road. So it actually is dangerous in the South to drive when it's bad weather.
No. What do you drive?
I drive a Volkswagen Atlas.
Is to
It's an
Volkswagen.
SUV.
Okay.
Yep.
So it does okay in the
Yeah,
snow.
no. And I did my residency in Connecticut, so having to drive in the snow and the ice for 4 years, I'm not a bad driver. Other people are bad drivers.
Sounds like you graduated your snow residency.
I did. I did. Yeah.
Yeah, Connecticut gets a few inches. How often does it snow in Tennessee? I'm not familiar with the weather there.
We get a little bit of snow. If we're lucky, we get a few inches to play, build snowmen and play in. But we usually get ice, and then it'll freeze. Like it can get cold, and then when the water freezes overnight, and then we're trying to drive, it can be dangerous.
Yeah, no. Oh, that's not great. Do you snowboard, ski, anything?
I ski. I just got back from Utah.
That's right. You just got. Wait, were you in Park City?
We ski in Brighton and Solitude, so it's across the canyon from Park City. But we do ski in Park City sometimes, just not this trip.
How about Deer Valley?
We love to ski Deer Valley. My family members, so it's complicated. My husband's half brother, his mom works at Deer Valley, and she can get us passes to Deer Valley, which is awesome.
All right. Well, we're gonna have to talk about this because I love that area. Utah has the greatest skiing. I think
Utah has the best skiing.
it's the best. The powder is just it's like a different world over there.
And
You
we
know?
got powder this weekend. It snowed every day. It was
That's right.
great.
I did
But
see
you
that
ski, you
story.
don't snowboard, right?
Correct.
Okay. Because Deer Valley, there's no snowboarding.
I know we didn't get to ski. I went to Park City. This is about five, a little over five. Oh wow, that was like 8 years ago now. But Park City, and then you have that was it like the gondola that connects to the canyons
Yes.
on the other side. The
Yeah.
beautiful town in Park City to go out and the restaurants. We didn't get to ski Deer Valley, but we ate there. Is that I
Yeah.
don't know if that's like normal.
It is an international place to travel now, Deer Valley. Like when we go, it's top level, high-end dining, like VIP service. They'll get your skis off your car for you. It's all posh and everything, which is kind of fun.
It is. When we were there that one night, exactly what you said, exquisite dining, very nice, very proper. There was this TV celebrity. Is it Conan O'Brien? I think it was Conan O'Brien who was there. He's like really tall, but it was like, whoa, this place is kind of busy, you know?
Yes, definitely some celebrities. And then with Sundance in Park City, it brings out the celebrities every January.
I miss skiing. Did you have to go through? When did you start skiing? I'm curious.
When did I start skiing where? Sorry.
Just when did you start skiing? Like in
Oh,
your.
when did I learn? I went skiing a couple times in high school out to Colorado. And it's probably the same personality that made me want to go into oral surgery. It was like all or nothing, just
Yep.
like I'm going to go down this hill as fast as I can and I'll figure out how to turn and stop, and I loved it. It was just adrenaline, high speed, and I'm fairly athletic, so I think I just kind of figured it out. And my husband and I have been married 20 years, so we've been together about 22, 23 years, and with his family in Utah, we've skied out there the past 20 years.
That's not so
We go
he's from
yearly, yeah,
his family's
to
in you
Utah. Yeah, we leave our ski stuff out there because we just don't ski anywhere else.
it's the best and it you have something to do when you go there. You're looking forward
Yeah.
to it. It's a complete change of scenery, right, from Tennessee
It
because now you're in
is.
the mountain and then
Yeah.
Wow, that is, well, first of all, congratulations, 22 years. And that's excellent. You know, yeah. And for surgeons, as dentists, doctors, I think even lawyers, the divorce rate is climbing up and up and up. So I got to give you flowers for that. That's excellent. That's something I aspire to be.
Well, he's an attorney, so we kind of have the double, but we met when I was in dental school and we got engaged literally the day I graduated dental school. I was not real happy with him, but I did say yes. I thought it was a little much to propose the day I graduated, but I said yes, and I said, okay, if we can get through the first year residency, we should be golden, because I knew it was going to be challenging, right?
But you did it. You did it. Yeah, why? Did he tell you why? That's a lot all one day. Graduation, proposing.
I think he was trying to get it in before I actually became officially a doctor, but he won't admit that.
I get it. To be honest, though, right?
You know, he had said he was trying to for multiple days and had something planned out and it fell through. And it was just kind of like, I got to do this now.
Yeah. And that's, oh man, a lot of excitement at once.
Real quick,
you mentioned going as fast as you can down the slopes, because I get a lot of this from friends who ski, snowboard, et cetera. Do you ever have any doubts or any, like, of getting injured while you're on the slopes? You know what I mean? Does that ever kind of run through your...
It does now that I'm a surgeon, and in the past few years, absolutely, because the last thing you want to do is injure, you know, your fingers, your hand, your wrist, your arm, not be able to operate. When I was younger, absolutely, had no fear, just enjoyed the adrenaline. Now when I go, I'm not so worried about it. I think I'm more confident in my abilities and mature enough to realize I don't need to go down things I don't need to go down.
Right, you know, right, right.
I don't
right,
have
right.
to prove to anybody that I can go down a black. I don't need to do that. It's okay.
And there's so many slopes out there. It's like, you don't have to.
Yeah. I just do it for the enjoyment. I don't need to prove anything anymore.
And you've been skiing for long enough, multiplied by the fact that you're such an athlete, where, yeah, because that's really good. You don't want to doubt yourself going down. I've been skiing my whole life, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a concern, you know? You don't want to get hurt. I mean, you could be walking down the street and get hurt, but...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I literally, speaking of running, and because I do run, I've had some weird physical ailments over the last few years. But one morning, 2 or 3 years ago, I'm not really sure, I run usually early in the morning. That's the only time I can get it done before life happens and I get too busy.
Great point.
And so that usually means it's dark. And so I'd been doing a tough workout. I'd been to the track. I was coming back. My legs were fatigued, kind of heavy feeling. And anyway, I was coming back and I was on the sidewalk and I missed kind of like a ledge, tripped over it, didn't even realize I was falling until I hit the concrete, hit my chin, split my chin open, and broke my left condyle.
Oh my God.
Just running on the concrete, yeah.
Oh, you were running back? They weren't walking?
No, I was running, yeah.
Man, on the concrete, that's a bad fall.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, it can happen anywhere.
Jesus, my goodness, how's the condyle on that side now?
It's much better. So I went to an oral surgery friend. He stitched me up because, of course, I'm not going to go to the emergency room. No one wants to go to the emergency room unless they're dying. So he stitched me up, did a CT. We looked at it and we're both like, we're not operating. Nope. And I was like, you're not putting arch bars. You're not doing any of that. Nope. I will do a soft diet for as long as I need to. And now I can empathize, you know, with my orthognathic patients and my fracture patients, and I can tell them pizza in a blender is not good. Do not recommend it.
Ew. Oh, that's gross. Oh,
it was gross. It was.
What would you recommend? Now, but we're on the diet topic.
I did a lot of mashed potatoes and gravy.
Okay.
And sweets. Okay. You get tired of the sweet stuff. I did lots of high protein shakes and stuff like that, but then you kind of get tired of it, so. The salty, some mashed potatoes and gravy and soups and stuff. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. That's what I usually, who doesn't like mashed potatoes and gravy?
I know. It's so good.
That's great. That's great that it wasn't an open, you know, or a procedure.
No, it was non-displaced. It just, you know, it was a bummer. It hurt. It took a while for my occlusion to kind of go back, but all good now.
Oh, maybe swallow in the area.
Yeah.
And then does that make you nervous or kind of worried?
Oh, yeah.
Now?
Oh, yeah. I definitely had some issues running when it was dark for a while, where I would hesitate or run a slower pace than I was used to running because I was more hesitant. But
did you, when you were healing, were you still going for runs?
Oh my gosh. Well, yeah. And
I knew it.
My life is nuts. Yeah. So I was actually on call. I was taking trauma call, and I actually operated the same day on a little girl who had fallen off her bike, you know, over the front of the handlebars, split her chin open and broke her condyle.
No way.
Oh, yeah. And then she had also split, like, she also had like a, you know, opposite side, like body fracture or something. So I actually had to operate on her. I've got this great photo of the two of us kind of like.
This sucks too. That is condyle, chin, yeah. And then body. But yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
Well, you still running in the dark, or are you kind of?
I run in the dark. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's the only time to get it done is early in the morning.
Yeah, true. So yeah. What are your hours? Did you work today?
Did not work today. So right now, the job I'm in a group private practice, and I'm working 2 to 3 days a week, just kind of depending on how busy the days get. We try to be more efficient. So I'll have 2 packed days instead of 3 kind of so-so days.
Yeah.
And then the office I work in, I split my clinic time with another female oral surgeon. And so we cover the whole week based on patients and schedules. Yeah.
It's how really far away? How far away is your office? Is it close by? It's in your area? Or you got to drive?
It's a 20-minute drive. It can take a while to get there depending on traffic. It's not like right around the corner. I can't pop home for lunch. But it's not bad. I've definitely had longer commutes. So
yeah. I've seen some of the things all. I'm like, what was it, Commander? Wait, am I?
I was Commander in the Navy. Yeah,
for I served 9 years in the Navy. 9 years, right?
I did 9 years.
And forgive me, it's embarrassing. I do have people in the Navy and the Army in my family that are in the forces. I'm not sure where Commander ranks in the.
So the Navy wants to be completely different from the other branches of the service. So the way officer rank goes is an ensign, Lieutenant JG, a Lieutenant, Lieutenant Commander, then Captain. So Commander would be an O5. And then the next level would be an O6, which would be a Captain in the Navy. And then O7 would be Admiral. 9 years, you move up in rank. Yeah.
Yeah, you're pretty badass. Oh my goodness.
I've done a lot of things. I've made a lot of mistakes. I've learned along the way. Yeah.
Experience is excellent. You want an experienced surgeon in all facets of life, I would say. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You see very unidimensional people, especially in academics or any career. But no, you're so experienced. And we were talking about that yesterday. We could touch on private practice. We could touch on corporate. We could talk on the force. Yes. You know? Yeah. We could go any direction right now. Why didn't you go up into captain? Was that it after those years or?
Yeah, so the way my contract worked with the Navy, I did the HPSP program for dental school. So 4 years, they pay for dental school, I owed 4 years. After my first year in dental school, I realized I wanted to specialize. I wanted to do oral surgery. I was sold on it, loved it, committed to it. Then I had to negotiate with the Navy because I was contracted to 4 years. They didn't want to just defer that time. The person I negotiated with, and since then I've learned everybody has different negotiations, everybody has different contracts, but mine specifically was that if I matched in a program, so I did not do my training through the Navy, I went like the regular pass application and interviews and stuff like that. But if I had matched in a 4-year program, they would not allow me to do a 6-year program, that I would owe 5 more years for a 4-year program. So that's how I ended up doing 4 years of dental school, 4 years of residency, and owed 9 years in the Navy. While in the Navy as an oral surgeon, first duty station was in Norfolk, Virginia for 2 years, then 3 years in San Diego, where my twins were born, then a year in Okinawa, and then 3 years in Washington, D.C. And my husband is a Naval Academy graduate and was a surface warfare officer and then went to law school while I was in residency. So he was a judge or a Navy lawyer, and they did not co-locate us or kind of keep us together. So, for example, my twins were born in San Diego. My husband was deployed on an aircraft carrier for back-to-back deployments. And then I got orders to Okinawa, Japan. He got orders to Afghanistan, which then got canceled, and he ended up in Washington, D.C. So I lived alone in Japan with my twins, working at the hospital as an oral surgeon. Oh. So after my 9 years, I'd had enough.
Yeah, I had enough just back and forth to Japan.
Yes.
What?
Yeah.
How long were you in Japan for?
We have a huge Navy base in Okinawa.
How
long was I there? 1 year. I was supposed to be 3 years. And I served a year, and it was really hard. My twins were 2 years old at the time, or they had just turned 3. And I had no family, no spouse. I was working at the hospital. So I was a hospital oral surgeon and taking call and stuff. And it was just,
You're constantly swamped. And now they're 3 years old. They're starting to develop into that stage where, you know, they're going to remember these things. Oh,
yeah.
Man. and you're never around. You're working. You're always working, I'm sure.
Right. And then even like daycare, you know, it's only set hours and then you only get a certain amount of money to be in the military. You can't work outside of the military. Well, at least not in Japan. So, you know, I couldn't really, it was just hard.
So restricted. Countries everywhere you look. I mean, I can't imagine that. And then your husband's on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
No help. No help whatsoever. And there's no opportunity to get help. And you said your husband's a lawyer. He was a judge?
Yes.
Still a judge?
Well, he was a judge in the Navy. And now he is a prosecutor for Knox County.
Wow. And so he went to law school while you were in residency. Got it.
He did.
So you must have met, I'm assuming, because he was in also the Navy.
We met while I was in dental school. I went to dental school at University of Tennessee in Memphis. And my husband was stationed in New Orleans at the time. And he was playing rugby for the men's team. And ended up playing a match in Memphis. And we met at a bar. So it had nothing to do with the Navy.
That's awesome, yes. Though. But like, yeah, similar. But you were already in HSPC during that time. You were already...
I was. Yeah. And the summer, let me think. I think it was the summer. Yeah. Summer between, right before my third year of dental school, I went out to San Diego to do an externship with their oral surgery program to learn more. So I spent a month working with them, partially because the oral surgery program at my dental school wouldn't allow me to spend time with the residents because I was a woman and they were all men and they didn't feel comfortable having a woman with them. So I went out to San Diego. He went out to San Diego to do some training and we spent about a month together. And we ran the San Diego Rock and Roll Marathon, and our relationship kind of worked out. Yeah.
This is the perfect love story. And there you go, 22 years later, you're still like, I love this. I love this. That's how it should be. My goodness, you guys had to struggle at times with the distance.
We did. We did. And with any kind of relationship, you know, there's going to be ups and downs, and there's going to be hard patches, but you've got to go through it together. You can't do it on your own, or you can't do it separately, or the relationship just doesn't work. You know, we're not perfect. Obviously, we disagree on things, but he's been my biggest support and my rock through all the hard stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And plus, you know, he's a judge. It's not like you're going to argue with him, right?
I just say it's stupid. That's my only argument. And then he gives up.
All right. You got that bingo card, the Uno cards.
That's stupid. Okay, we're done.
What's now? I'm curious because I'm in a relationship that's really picking up, and it's 4.5 years now. What's kind of your secret with your husband? What's one thing you could always rely on? Like, hey, you know, let's talk this out, or hey, you know, you want to go do that thing that whatever is your favorite?
Oh yeah.
What kind of tricks do you have?
We learned really. I think going through residency together 100% helped solidify our relationship early on. He learned very early, do not talk to me the minute I come home. Give me at least 15, 20 minutes to decompress. Don't bombard me the minute I walk in. Let me have my space. I think he also learned through residency that not to be too critical or too sensitive about, you know, my emotions, because in residency, you're kind of all over the place. I mean, I feel like my worst version of myself was when I was an oral surgery resident. So we worked through a lot of those issues during that time. So even though we've been through rough patches, I feel like it's not as bad as it was then. Listening to each other, telling him, I want you to listen, just to listen, not solve the problem, you know?
Yeah. That's all. Yeah. These are some great tidbits. I never thought of how coming home, as soon as you're home, you're in your safe space now.
Yeah.
And you do need that time to just, even 15 minutes, to decompress and just kind of unwind and unravel some of the knots that came up during the day. That is such a good point. I've never kind of defined that. I know exactly what you're talking about. I've never had the chance to really define that. I really appreciate that. That's a good one. And then, yeah, when you bring up these problems, these issues, or this happened, that happened today, sometimes you just kind of need to talk it out, not necessarily be bombarded by someone else's perspective and proposed solution, if you will.
Yeah. So even now that I have kids, I have teenagers, I have boy-girl twins, they're 15 years old. And even now with my kids, I'll say, they'll be talking or explaining something, and I'll have to stop and say, do you want me to listen or do you want me to try to find a solution?
Oh.
And sometimes they'll say, you know, I want you to help me. Or sometimes they'll say, I don't know. And sometimes it's just, I just wanted to tell you about it.
Right. I bet it's such a good point. I've never thought of it that clearly. It's funny. You remind me of my cousin in Florida, who's an attorney, actually. And he has that kind of receptive sense, like, oh, they're just talking because they got to talk it out right now, or they're looking for a proposed solution. That's great.
Yeah.
How does it feel? You're a mom, you're an athlete, you're a skier, you're a surgeon. You're doing it all.
I love it. And there's even more I want to do.
Okay. What's the next move? What's on your mind?
There's just so many things. I love traveling. Traveling is where we spend our extra time and our extra money. And so many places I've been to and visited, and I want to go back, but then there's other places I want to go to. So most of my free time when I'm not doing one of those other things is planning our next big adventure or our trip, or, and I like to get into the nitty gritty of it and figure out the logistics of it, the where we're going to go, what we're going to eat, where we're going to see. And I have a tendency to overpack things because I'm just that kind of personality where I like to go, go, go and see and do. So, yeah.
You got to make the most of it, right?
Yes.
This past weekend, how long were you there in Utah, by the way?
We were there 4 nights.
Okay. A little bit quicker. Did you jam pack this, or was this kind of more of a just let's go ski?
This was all about skiing. We stayed near both Solitude and Brighton. And I mean, we went and got our gear, drove up to the mountains. My brother-in-law, they own an A-frame. So we stayed with them. And I mean, we just skied all day, and then flew back home.
What's an A-frame? I'm not familiar.
A-frame, like a foam that, you know, it's built like with the roof. It's like an A-frame. Did it not come out? Did my Southern accent like?
Oh, no. I don't know. I don't know. That. I guess that's a topic I don't know much about with the houses and the structure. I've seen them though, like in the mountain. You see them in the Adirondacks a lot. Yeah, I know. I the A-frame now.
Yes.
That's awesome. What's the next trip? What are you thinking as far as the next trip where you are going to jam pack in events and plan it?
Yeah. So this summer, we, meaning my family, my kids and my husband, and then my sister and then her son and her husband and our dogs are going to the Pacific Northwest. And so I've got an itinerary where we're flying into Portland. We're going to check out kind of some of Oregon, and then we're going to drive down the coast, see the Redwoods in Northern California. Drive up the highway all the way up to like Forks in Washington and then out of Seattle.
You said that some places you would go again versus new. Is this a new trip or one that you've been?
This is parts I've been to, but not all of it. So this is kind of a new trip.
Okay. Have you seen the Redwoods before?
I have not seen this national forest, no.
I've never seen it either. I just keep hearing and seeing these photos on Instagram of these trees that just
beautiful.
Keep going up in the sky.
Yes.
And you said, well, how many dogs do you have? What kind of?
I have one dog. We have a Shih Tzu that we got during the pandemic. He's been the baby of the family now.
It's so funny, Mike.
He's a good traveler. He's been out west. He's been to Yellowstone. He likes to go to the beach. He travels well.
He likes water and the beach and the sand? Yeah?
Yeah, he does.
Really? So that's so funny you mentioned that. My girlfriend has a Shih Tzu and hates the rain. Like, won't even walk outside. And it's like, come on, you got to go pee. Come on. And the biggest attitude will bark and bite at the biggest dog on the block.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, he's got the little man syndrome. He thinks he's a big, tough guy.
The little Napoleon syndrome, right?
What's the name of your Shih Tzu or your girlfriend's Shih Tzu?
His name is Nico, but you know how dogs, they get like this like nickname?
Yes, halfway? Of course. Lots of nicknames.
Right? What's your dog's name?
Ollie.
Ollie. Does Ollie have any nicknames?
Ollie has lots of nicknames. His most recent nickname is Schmumpy, and I have no idea how he got that name.
Is that from you or the kids? Or
probably the kids, a little Schmumpy or something.
Blame it on the kids.
Blame my husband.
So Nico's nickname, they called him Chungy. Apparently it's like pushy or smushy because he's like I want to, you know, he's a fluffy Shih Tzu, you know? Yeah. And one day they had this really tight, kind of like fraternity guy looking turtleneck on. And I was like, he totally looks like a Gilbert or something right now. He looks like a frat president or something. Like he's the biggest douchebag when he goes out for his walks. And then so I was like, he's like a Chungbert, you know? So now, I call him Chungbert. It like kind of combined over time into this new nickname.
Oh, yeah.
But it's funny how Shih Tzus can have such attitudes. Like they're so cuddly and lovable. And then as soon as they step foot outside, like the apartment, they're barking at anything that moves.
They're very protective. I've found mine is very protective. He feels threatened, you know, that a big dog or somebody's going to attack me when we're walking. Yeah.
Well, you know what they say, right? It's not the size of the dog. It's not the size of the heart in the dog or, you know, whatever.
It's very true. Absolutely.
So I wanted to ask you about, actually, someone requested that I ask you about the HPSP.
Yeah, the Health Profession Scholarship Program, HPSP.
HPSP. SP. Yeah. Any details that you have on that? I'm not familiar with that at all. I just know that it has to correlate with, you know, your education, and then you have to serve time after.
Yeah. So kind of what I was alluding to earlier is, and I didn't realize this until once I was active duty Navy, is that the contracts are all very different. So a Health Profession Scholarship Program, you can apply for a 4-year or a 3-year, from my understanding. And different branches of the military have different contracts. So the Air Force is different than the Navy and the Army. But essentially, you apply, you go through an application process. You also go through a physical examination, which was ridiculous.
Why was it ridiculous?
I had to duck walk. Who does a duck? Like, what does that tell you?
I'm going to be an oral surgeon. Why am I duck walking?
Duck walk. Yeah, this was in college because I applied for mine when I was in college. But yeah, duck walk. I don't know. Anyway, it felt very like 1930s or 1940s. Did not make any sense. But I applied for it. I was accepted to it. They pay for, they meaning the military branch, will pay for your tuition. They pay for books. I don't know if you guys still use books in dental school. We use books.
Yeah. A lot to pay for.
You know, instruments, supplies, and then they'll pay you a small, like, living expense. I forget what they call it, the terminology for it.
Like stipend or something.
Stipend. Yes, a living stipend or a stipend to pay for living expenses. Most of the time, it's a small amount. So I ended up still taking out student loans, but it was a fraction of the cost of most of my other friends that were in dental school. And then you owe them time in the military. Specifically, when I was in the Navy, a lot of people coming out of dental school wouldn't necessarily take their dental board examinations because the Navy would feed you into an AEGD or GPR kind of a program as a way to kind of level the playing field, because they had all these people, all these dentists coming in from all these different dental schools. And they were, you know, some people have more clinical experience than other dental schools. And so in order to kind of level the playing field, they'd put you in one of these programs just to make sure that you knew what you're getting into before they would send you out to a clinic where maybe you're the only dentist there. Because there are some duty stations, like on a ship or in some clinics, where you can't, you know, get advice from another dentist. So most of the time you graduate dental school and then you go into an AGD or a GPR program. One of the benefits of those programs are that it then can feed into residencies pretty easily. They have some really great residency programs. So if you're interested in pursuing any of the residencies and programs, it's a lot smaller applicant pool that they're taking from. So you have a greater chance of specializing in the military.
So there's quite a few benefits there. But then you were saying you have to serve time afterwards. But I know you said that the contract, you know, the negotiations are all different for everyone. I was told just generally it's like if you take, or, you know, they fund your education for, say, 4 years, you have to serve 4 years, or is it more than that? I don't know if you could.
See, that's where some of the contracts differ. Some of them, yes, you come in, you serve your 4 years. Some of them, if you do one of those residencies, which they're pushing people into, those GPR or AGD, then you owe additional time. Mm-hmm. And so if I'd advise anybody that's, you know, looking at these, read the contract and negotiate the contract, because you do have leverage. They may make you think you don't have leverage, but you do. And then even go to the different branches and see what each of the branches will offer you. Take the Navy and compare it to the Air Force.
That's a great idea.
Because they're similar, but there are differences. And there may be a benefit to one or the other, or you can use one to negotiate with the other.
That's such a great idea. Yeah. And then use it as bargaining power against the other. That's brilliant. Wow. If you were to do it again, would you do it the same way that you did it?
It's hard to say. My life was different because I served in the military. I did get to experience some things that other people will never get to experience. I met some amazing people. I learned a lot of things I never knew existed or that I would need to learn about leadership, running medical departments, how hospitals run, how ships run, how the military runs. Looking back at the delay, meaning I served 9 years in the military, and then I came out as a practicing oral surgeon trying to go into a private practice, and that was challenging. Challenging for a couple of different reasons. One, I'd already been practicing and kind of developed my own techniques or skills or the way I wanted to do things. Two, I felt like I was kind of behind the power curve, meaning in the military, you have a set salary that you're getting paid. Whereas if you look at somebody that's been out of residency for 9 or 10 years, they're probably well established in their practice. They've either bought in, they're making good money, they may have some assets that they've accrued over, you know, living those 9 or 10 years in one place. So, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say.
In addition to the sacrifice, I mean, you're all the way in Japan, you're on the West Coast, you're on the East Coast. And my God, I'm thinking about, I mean, I'm not complaining outright, but, you know, complaints of, you know, the sacrifice of time that I've personally gone through as far as dental school, as far as residency. I'm not in Japan right now, you know, and I could see my significant other on the weekends. So it's not like that bad. It's different, but you do
put things on hold during residency, and you feel like you are behind, say, the person that goes into medical or pharmaceutical sales. You know, there's so many days I'm like, why didn't I do that?
Oh, tremendous.
Then I would be unhappy.
Yeah. One of my best friends, he's an investment banking 4 years degree out of a great business school, went into banking, and, you know, similar hours, I would say, different work, obviously, but the same effort that's required. But the difference is, you know, they get compensated for it, whereas, you know, our route, we don't get compensated for it, at least through the training, at least through the education part of it. And education just drags on forever and ever. And that's such a great point, how it's different. I'm very curious, what did you do then after when you came out? It was hard to find that position. Everyone's well established and they didn't work in 9 years. What did you do right from there?
Yeah, so part of the reason I was joking with you, you know, on messaging, you know, I've kind of done a little bit of everything is, it is hard. And when I first was looking to get out of the military, I had a good friend that I knew from dental school. We had kept in touch in residency. I knew I wanted to kind of come back to the South. My mom was sick at the time with cancer, and I felt it was important to be close to her and her to get to know her grandkids and them to get to know her. She has since passed away, but I felt like it was important to do that, to be closer to family after being gone a while. So really, I joined that practice thinking, okay, this is going to be great. I know this guy. We've gone to school together. We know each other. And it didn't work out, and it was really, really hard. A lot of different reasons for why it didn't work out. And then after that, I felt like I couldn't really trust anybody else because I felt like I had a good friend that kind of betrayed me. So I tried to start my own practice and opened it in January 2019. I made a lot of mistakes, I realize now. But then the pandemic hit and I was working for two different DSO companies trying to make payments for this practice that I had opened, trying to build it up and get referrals and keep the practice going. And it was just absolutely destroying me. I was working too much. I was, you know, putting all this time and this effort into building this practice. It just wasn't getting off the ground. So I worked for that probably about 3 or 4 years, tried to get that going. And it just, I mentioned earlier, I had some health issues too. And it just became very apparent that it wasn't going to work out. So I sold the practice, sold the building, sold the practice and stuff. And I went into academics for about a year and a half.
Where'd you go?
So in Knoxville, they opened up Lincoln Memorial Dental School. It's a private dental school with some grants and funding for the Appalachian people in this area.
Oh, yeah. LMU. Yeah. I'm familiar a little bit with it. It's new. Yeah.
It's very new. And unfortunately, I pointed out some problems with, I felt like patient safety, some issues with, I didn't feel like things were being done correctly. And I just didn't feel comfortable working in an environment that wasn't safe. So I left and went into private practice again, this time into a group private practice. The difference was I had met one of the oral surgeons in the group, another woman oral surgeon who had moved to the area and helped build this group practice. And she and I worked together at LMU. And we both left at the same time. And she took me into her private practice where I've been for almost the last year.
Cool. You got that connection while you're at LMU.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And we got to work together. And I was thinking about all the different places I've worked and coming onto this podcast. And sure, there's some things I did wrong, 100%. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, a career doesn't have to be a linear thing. You know, you can branch off and do lots of different things. And I feel like we have a great opportunity to where we can maybe scale back and not work quite as many hours if there's a period of our time, say when we have young children or we have a medical condition, and then we can go back in and work really hard and work a lot of hours. And I hate that most people feel like you have to do an all or nothing. Right. I feel like we should be able to kind of create these niches or these ways of practicing oral surgery that's maybe not all just one way.
I 100% agree, right? you got to optimize it for yourself. And if you can optimize it for yourself, you can make the patient experience even better because you're catching stride, as we say, right? When we're running, we're finally getting to the groove of things,
yeah.
Getting a good pace going. I like that you were saying how you switch. You work 2 to 3 days a week. She works 2 to 3 days
yes.
a week. Any weekends or is this strictly weekdays?
We don't work any weekends now. And then we cover for each other. For example, when I was out of town in Utah, she covered those days. And then when she's out of town, I cover her days. So it works out really well. And we have each other's backs and we trust each other, which I think is really important. With the practice, it's a relationship and you have to be able to communicate and support each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And is she a partner? Are you a partner in the practice? Is that
she is a partner and I am in the buy-in stage.
Excellent.
Yeah. You got to invest in yourself, right?
That's right. That's right. And then you're your own boss, you know, that's the best.
Yeah.
What
about you? You're finishing up, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Less than just about 4 months now.
How many days? You got the days counting?
Oh, no. No. I count the days up through residency. Just, I don't know, show like the process and the story as we go. Just, I don't know, something to look back on one day maybe. I'm looking at the kind of like the week countdown a little bit, the months.
Good.
But it's so close, like June 2nd or 3rd, done.
Perfect. Do you know what you're going to do?
Yeah. I signed back in like July, August. I signed with a practice out on Long Island. It's a multi-practice private. I'm not really a fan of the DSO scene right
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
Did you like that? I mean, you said you kind of spread yourself thin, which, you know, wasn't fair to yourself, but you were two different DSOs or one at two different offices?
I have worked with three different DSOs, three different DSO companies.
Mm.
Well, one DSO was kind of an oral surgery specific.
Oh, and the others weren't.
The others were like, you know, Pacific Dental, Aspen Dental, stuff like that, that are more. And then I also did ad locums where I traveled and did oral surgery. You know, you can make some good money. You can make some great money. Is it worth it? You know, hard to say. For the time, I needed it and it worked out well, but it was a limited thing. And I felt like just because I could do something, just because I could do 14, 15 sedations doesn't mean I should be doing that many. It was a lot.
In a day.
It was a lot. They work you hard.
It's a lot. Yeah, that's a lot. And it's got to be like they make it into a tough thing. Oh, you don't want to make a lot of money? I don't know if that's right. What this is about. What about safety, patient safety?
Yes, and that's ultimately where I had to draw the line, where I felt like it was not safe. It was not the best interest of the patients. I felt like I was kind of put into some bad situations that I wasn't comfortable with. But you know, for some people, it's a good deal. They don't have to worry about overhead. They don't have to worry about, well, overhead if they're a W-2 employee. If you're an independent contractor, then you're bringing all your stuff in and setting it up. So there's different ways to look. And I've done both those. I've done independent contractor where I brought all of my instruments, equipment, anesthesia. I even brought assistants with me. And that's one way of doing it. Or there's a way where you go into the office and they are supposed to provide everything for you.
I see what you did there.
Yes. Yes.
Exactly what you mean. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I talk to attorneys and they say the majority of these malpractice suits, they come from DSOs. I mean, just the quantity of people, and you have to, unfortunately, you have to, you know, not limit your focus. Your focus decreases in order to maximize the quantity that you're looking at, right? And the quality decreases. And
yes.
I don't know. I don't know. You can make all the excuses in the world for it, but it's like, you're forgetting the number one thing at the end of the day. And I think patient-centered care, we got to get back there. But
we do. But there are a lot of oral surgery practices that sell to DSOs that then let them run their practice the way they were running it as a private practice. So there's a lot of private practices out there that you wouldn't know are owned.
Oh, yeah. By all practices. Yeah.
And unfortunately, fortunately, a lot happened during the pandemic. I mean, in Knoxville, forget how many oral surgery groups we have here, but there's probably only one or two that are still privately owned. The rest sold to corporations.
Yeah. The pandemic really, I mean, they shut down their practices for 3 months. And it's like, how do you pay your staff? How do you keep the office? So you got to take a loan to do that. And then when are you going to pay off that loan? That's going to take a hit of your income. And I get it. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, a lot of these people, it might be an unmarked office. They get to run it the same way, but as soon as they retire, they leave that practice, that DSO steps in, and then they change everything the way they want to do it.
And turn
it into that, you know?
That's another thing is a lot of, or at least in the South, I've seen a lot of these guys are wanting to retire. I say guys because they're all men. are wanting to retire and they can't find someone to come in and can't afford to buy the practice or buy them out. And so, you know, they try to find someone to come in and they can't find someone that can buy them out, you know, so then they end up selling it to a DSO or someone comes right out of residency and they owe $400,000 in student loans. They can't buy into a private practice. They got to go work for a DSO for a few years until they can make some money.
Yep. It's tough. It's tough. I don't know if it's not sustainable. I think that's the best way to put it. And then, you know, most people, and I ask students these days, do you want to be your own boss or anything? Like what do you dream about going to dentistry versus medicine? Why didn't you want to go into medicine? And a lot of them, they want to be their own bosses one day. You know, there's a percentage of them that aren't going to be able to handle it. They're going to find out this isn't for me. But there's a big percentage that have that aspiration, that ambition to do it. And I do think that they can. And that availability, that access to owning their own office, it's going to be a completely different landscape. They're not going to have the financial support to begin it. And then by the time they get there, they're 40, 45. And it's like, you're going to have 10, 15 years. Maybe you get lucky and you push past 65, but it's like, you're literally saving up for half your career. Then you do it for 15, 20 years. And that's, I don't know, it's a different lifestyle. So what we were talking about before, the delayed gratification we already go through, I don't know, there's a big disparity between like, not even gratification, just like what makes it worth it going in to finally balance it out with the output that it gives you to afford that quality of life that you dreamed of. And
absolutely.
It's an issue. It's an issue. Yeah. It's an ever increasing issue.
So back to Long Island, huh?
Back to Long Island.
So I have to tell you, I did my training over in New Haven, Connecticut, and we did a rotation at LIJ for our pathology.
Oh, no way.
So I spent a month at LIJ working with their oral pathology department.
That's so funny. I have a friend who actually just went down to Maryland. He was an LIJ pathologist there. It's like a very active department, right?
Very active. I tell everybody, I learned so much. I hated having to go do oral pathology and look at microscopic labs and histology and stuff, but I learned so much because they run a clinic. They see their own patients. They did their own biopsies. They did their own treatment. It's helped me a lot in my career because, you know, no one wants to treat the burning mouth, burning tongue patient.
Yeah. Do you treat them in your practice?
I feel like I have a good grasp of pathology, so I end up getting quite a few. And I've kind of always been that little black rain cloud. You know, even on trauma call, always get the weird stuff. So I always get some bizarre pathology that walks into my clinic.
You're black cloud.
Yes.
How often are you taking call right now?
I actually resigned. I was taking call at the University of Tennessee with their oral surgery department. It's a level one trauma center.
Hey.
I wanted to work with the residents. I loved working with them. I tried to negotiate a better pay structure. The hospital was not billing for the trauma services that we were providing. They were having us try and bill as private practitioners, and we weren't able to get reimbursement. So essentially, we were working for free. And so I found out what other people were getting paid to take level one trauma care and try to negotiate it. And the program director shot me down. And then there were some other microaggressions and harassment. And I was the only female oral surgeon, and I thought it just wasn't worth it to not be treated the same.
Great. I agree. And you know, these hospitals all over are not paying surgeons to take in the Northeast here all the time. I'm talking to these doctors and they're like, they don't pay us to take call. Why should we take call in your hospital then if you're not going to pay? I'm not billing that. I'm not taking my time to pay out, to bill out. Why do we have to do that?
We shouldn't. And they're in the hospital. They're leaving money on the table because, you know, they're billing for everything else. So throw a mandible fracture into that whole billing code thing. Come on.
Right. And then like, hey, the surgeon who's doing it, one who's doing the work and treating the patient and then going to see them for the follow-ups. No,
correct.
I mean, and then what is it wouldn't be the ADA that's behind this, right? Would it be the oral surgery, American, you know, the AMIS?
I mean, right now it's really hospital dependent. You know, it depends on the hospital. And
who would stick up for surgeons? I mean, like to say like, all right, you know, we need to put our foot down. If an oral surgeon is going to work at your hospital, you know,
it has to be the department head of the oral surgery department or the oral surgeon in charge. And
yeah, and they're not going to
rock their boat.
Yeah, they're not going to rock their boat for another surgeon. And then to be a true board certified oral surgeon,
you have to have hospital privileges.
Exactly.
To be an ALOM member.
And
and then some hospitals, for example, I was taking call at the Children's Hospital here. Which I loved it, but they did not pay anything, $0 to take trauma call. And to have privileges, you had to take call. And I was like, no, I don't need to use your hospital, you know?
I think it's such a waste. And, you know, we went into this profession to help patients. And now they're making it where our time isn't worth anything.
Correct.
I think it's unacceptable. We need that empowerment as a profession. Who's going to step up? And I'm not going to take call if they're not going to. And it's not like it's tough because I'm still just going to be starting out. So I want to help out. I can't stand taking call like weekends and stuff. But, you know, for patients, there can be some. But then the fact is, like, I'm not going to do free. I'm not going to go. I'm trying to start a family
soon. We're not going to work for free. No one should have to work for free. And that's what I tell people. Like, I don't work for free anymore. I've served my time. I've been a resident. I've been in the military. I've done community service.
You wouldn't have done it all.
I paid my dues.
You've done it in Japan. Yeah, you have.
I paid my dues. I don't want to work for free anymore. It's a tough thing. And then if you're at all interested in becoming a fellow of the American College of Surgeons, I just went through that process because I was a single degree oral surgeon. And for a while, only dual degree could get fellowship status, be a fellow of the American College of Surgeons. So in order to do that, you have to have a case log of a minimum of 50 major OR cases in a 12-month period. They cannot be any dental alveolar cases. So that means you're taking trauma or you're doing a lot of pathology, reconstruction, you know, you got to find those cases. So
yeah.
And if
you're not taking call at a hospital, how are you going to get those?
Yeah. And most of us as oral surgeons don't take cases to the hospital. We have the privilege and the training to do it in the clinic or in our offices or use a surgical center.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. And then the compounding effect that we're starting to see up here is these hospitals, I got to remember not to name many hospitals that I'm affiliated with, but these hospitals have bought up these smaller outpatient or smaller hospitals, even level two, level three, way out there where they have no dentists, oral surgeons, what have you, and they don't have any specialists that can treat this.
Oh, yeah, is right. They refer them all into the level one trauma. Yeah, we have the same thing here. I mean, we have people coming from other states.
And they'll pass all their level one trauma centers in their ambulance just to keep it within the system so that they can do their whole billing thing.
Yes.
Is that right for the patient? If they're really intubated and they really need this, why are we... You just pass like four level ones on the way here.
Right. How about the bill pass that there's no surprise billing too, that you have to like consent them that you're going to charge them to do their surgery? Like, of course they're going to say yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But then when they get the bill, they're like, no, I'm not paying that.
Right. Of course. He never told me this. She never told me this. Yeah.
I didn't know that was going to cost me that. I thought it was included in my medical insurance.
Yeah. And then so that it's going to go down. I see the way this kind of transpiring is that it's going to come down to the institutions, the academic institutions where the training takes place. All the residents are going to be at these higher level institutions, the big hospital centers. And then they're going to be buying up all these little ones and transferring everything to the flagship hospital. But is that better patient care?
Oh, gosh, no. Well, if you don't have the specialist, yeah, but...
In the minutia, we can make the argument that, well, we got to get them to the specialist that could do this rather than trying to get another guy or girl to do this that doesn't have that training.
Right.
But how did we get to this point, which
is
all financial
compounding
effects that no one wants to talk about? Now, that's where we're looking.
It's all about making money.
The consolidation, and then it turns into monopolization.
Yes.
There's also going to be, I see there being an issue in research endeavors because a lot of the breakthroughs happen in like the outlier thing that they tried this thing different. But if everyone's following the same rules and regulations, they're in the same box, how far out can you branch to try that new, let's try this compound with that, whatever. I'd be questioning, trying to be foresighted, I think is, we're going to have a little bit limitation in, you know, breakthrough surgeries, if you will, unless it's within their guidelines and that it's completely facilitated by the institution itself. It makes it harder for the little guy, you know?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Unless you're like our big hospital and things that go down to the sterilization process and they disappear. And so then when you're doing your orthognathic case and you call for, say, a ramus retractor or an inferior border retractor. And they say, we don't have it. What do you mean you don't have it? It should be on the orthognathic pan, the tray, the case. Yeah. Nope, we don't know. Go down to the process. Get me my retractor. I need it to, you know, do my inferior, my cut.
We had this last week. Yeah, literally.
I need this. It comes on the kit. They can't find it. Literally happened to us a month ago. So we got innovative. We took the Minnesota. We flipped it upside down and we used that for our inferior border retractor.
That's good.
So.
But it's not ideal. And now you have to improvise and you're in the middle of a big surgery. No, I didn't even
Yeah.
think of that because we see that at all three hospitals that we cover.
Sure.
Everyone, they
Of
go down to
course.
sterilization, they come up a
And it
week later
disappears.
and they don't know where it went. What is that? What? No, we don't know.
We don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
It's like, Cynthia, we talked about this a week ago, you know?
Yeah. You just had this last night. Where'd it go? The mandible fracture. Yeah.
Yeah.
The other one, we were trying to use a trocar. We didn't have the part to the trocar, which they had used the night before, and then it disappeared.
The night
Always
before,
them.
it disappeared within 24 hours, like 12 hours.
Yeah. Which means it did get sterilized. They just don't want to admit it. Everyone didn't do their job.
These issues, this is just going to keep, it's going to become more issues are going to happen that we don't foresee. I don't
I
know.
know.
And then it affects patient care ultimately.
It
That's
does.
why I'm so concerned about it. Anyway, moving forward. So we both have a common interest running. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to post too many of my runs in the last, I mean, it's been really cold this year. There's been a lot of
Yeah.
snow. A lot of colds going around
Oh,
too.
yeah. Yeah, I'm getting over one.
Did you get any of the
Just a regular cold or
colds? There
virus
was
going around.
the norovirus was going around, a couple flus were going around. Did you get anything interesting this year?
Not the flu, just a run-of-the-mill virus, head cold kind of a thing, congested. But yeah, running. Yeah, no, I did not run but a handful of times my entire 4 years of residency. There was just no time.
Right.
There
How,
was no.
what's your usual routine? How many times in a week do you like run?
So I run an average of 4 or 5 times a week. It's usually in the mornings. It was 8 years ago now, I hired a running coach because I decided I wanted to qualify and run the Boston Marathon.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. So everybody said, you got to do a running coach. They'll just help program, plan things for you. So I've had the same running coach for 8 years, and I'm running my 7th consecutive Boston Marathon in April.
Congratulations. Oh my God. Wait, that's coming up in 2 months, huh?
Yeah.
Oh man, Boston. Wait, so were you at the Boston
Or was
Marathon when that
bombing?
explosion?
No,
Yeah.
that was several years before I started
Oh, thank
trying and
goodness.
qualifying for Boston. Yeah, but
Thank you.
my goal right now is to do 10 consecutive. That's the goal right now.
Think you can hit it?
If I can do, yes, I should be able to because I've qualified already for next year, so that'd be 8, and then I'll be aging up, so I get 5 more minutes. So I should be able to make it as long as I stay healthy.
Oh, you got this. You got to stay healthy. Yep. So four to five times a week.
Yeah, so the way our program works is we run Mondays and Wednesdays is like an easy pace, 6 or 7 miles. Tuesdays and Thursdays are track workouts, so like interval training, VO2 max, working on turnover, stuff like that. And then Saturdays are long runs.
But what is your long run work like?
So as you're building up for a marathon, usually he'll bump up the miles. Usually we start at like 10 miles, then it goes up 2 miles every weekend to where we're running up to 22 miles, and then every other weekend you'll run like 12 miles. So the most you'll do is like 22, 23 miles, and then you'll go and run the full marathon at 26.2.
And so you must be coming into that turn up right now pretty soon, right?
I am, but I did Houston Marathon in January, which is a pretty quick turnover, and I did something to my left side. As I'm aging, I'm getting these aches and pains and stuff. So I did something to my left, like hip and glute. So my physical therapist and I have been working on that. So my training for this Boston's a little different.
Why such a quick turnover? You're giving yourself 3 to 4 months to.
Because I ran Berlin in October and I missed the qualifying time for Boston by 4 seconds. So I signed up for Houston to qualify. So Boston is a technically challenging marathon. It is hard to run a really good marathon. So running a Boston qualifying time doesn't necessarily mean you get to run Boston because so many people will hit the time qualification for your age and gender that a lot of times you have to be faster than that qualifying time. So you kind of build in a safety net of saying, say, for example, your qualifying time is 3 hours and 45 minutes to get a Boston qualifying time. Then you would want to run at least 5 minutes faster than that to ensure you get in.
Right.
And in the past few years, it's been even faster. Like you've had to be 7 minutes faster than the qualifying time.
Why are they doing that? Is it just being
Just that many
competitive?
people. Yeah, it's become very popular and very competitive.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's fair. That's fair to go from, you said Berlin was October and then January and then,
Or
okay,
January and then
that's just a
April.
lot on your body.
Yeah, I have been running about 3 or 4 marathons a year.
Oh my God. One of my coworkers just did the New York City marathon, and he was like, I was making fun of him. I was like, well, you're gonna poop yourself tomorrow. And then all of a sudden he did, and he's like, I thought you jinxed my.
Oh, yeah. I've done New York twice. It is not my favorite marathon. It is logistically so challenging. You have to get up super early and take a ferry and take a bus and walk and get to all these places. And then by the time you get there, you're like, now I have to run? I'm exhausted.
That's right. And then, oh man. Oh my God. Yeah. And then it could be really cold. It could be really cold.
The weather is always a factor for marathons. Yeah. You can train, you know, like crazy and do everything perfect, but you cannot control the weather the day of the race.
Right. Right. Have you ever had to run? What's your favorite kind of weather? Do you like a little chilly?
The cold weather.
Okay. That's funny.
Yeah, my best marathons have been when it's cold or cold and rainy, which is, I guess my body temperature can just stay cooler and I'm not, you know, using that energy to warm my or to cool myself. So yeah, I like it colder.
Right. That's what my friend was saying. You know, my mom ran the New York City Marathon. This is going back 10, 20 years, but
nice.
I got to ask her if she prefers it warmer. I'm sure you've run marathons in like when it's wet and rainy.
Yeah. So 2 years ago, it rained in Boston the entire time. And then that year, I'm stupid crazy. Just let me put that out there. I ran Boston. The next day, I flew overnight to London. And then 4 days later, I ran the London Marathon. And it rained in London, too.
My God. Well done, first of all. That is so impressive.
I didn't know how it was going. It was kind of a... It was a risky move. I did not know how it was going to go, but it went better than I could have imagined, and I had a great time.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. How many marathons are you at right now?
This Boston will be number 30.
30 marathons. And yeah. How are the knees and hips? You said you had a little injury on...
Left hip is starting to bother me, but I'm 48 years old, so there's a lot of age on it too, you know?
Come on, it's just a number. The hips, though. Okay, left hip. Have you ever felt that tweak before? Or is this just a new...
Well, I have scoliosis, so my whole back and body is just a little crooked. So, you know, left side has been an issue. It just, I think it's just wear and tear.
Yeah.
Trying to do all the things, physical therapy, strength training, stretching, yoga, blah, blah, blah. But
yeah, that's, but thankfully no wipeouts since then, right?
No wipeouts since that one incident. Yeah.
All right. Good.
So what about you? You able to run during residency? Not consistently, I bet.
You're 100% correct. The consistency really lacks. You know, sometimes you'll just go, I hate to say it, you know, you'll go over a week and it's just like, I would say coming back from missing a week, maybe, you know, and I don't think I've gone more than 10 days, but coming back from that, you can run. I think the mental health aspect of it, just to go out on a run, fresh air, just to sweat out all the stress of like, just the day, the week in residency, you know, I think that's the biggest thing with exercise, like 100%. And really compounds. If you don't get a good sweaty run in, if you don't get that workout in, I notice it. I'm sure you would agree.
Oh, after I'm a different person. Yeah.
Right. 3 to 5 days. It's like it just like forms into a knot somewhere in there, you know, it's like weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it's therapeutic for a lot of different reasons.
What do people do when if they don't exercise? I know so many people that don't. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know. I think we're built differently.
That's probably right. So one other thing I wanted to touch on is writing. How did you get into as far as, you know, I'm sorry, wait, the title of the book, Behind the Scalp. I wanted to touch on this. When did you get into, where did this all come about? Like, how did this start? When did you do it?
So it kind of started with a bunch of us female oral surgeons that connected through social media. We hadn't trained together. We didn't know each other. I mean, when I started my program, I was the only female oral surgeon and I was the second one ever. There were no female oral surgeons. Even when I did my interviews, I met maybe two. There just weren't many of us. So probably about 6 years ago, a lot of us started connecting and finding each other through social media. Other people would introduce us. So Kathy, Hung, she's a female oral surgeon in New Jersey, decided she wanted to do something about it and put together this book. It was part of, I think she was working with the ADA on a diversity and inclusion kind of program. And part of it was to put together a book of stories and kind of like a guidebook for other, not only other women, but anybody in oral surgery of kind of some of the challenges and the things that we've been through. And then we put together a like a symposium, you know, for women to kind of get together and talk about our challenges and similarities and differences and stuff like that. Despite having the book out, we've kind of continued the friendships and the mentorships and getting together and meeting and working together. So it's been great.
I've seen, yeah, a couple comments from Dr. Rania Habib.
Yeah. So
I know her a bit through the social media pathway. I haven't connected with Kathy Hung yet in New Jersey, so not too far away.
Yeah, not too far.
She's on Instagram, right?
She is. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And okay. So did she kind of take that lead?
She was the lead author for the book.
Right. But who connected everyone to get into
it? I'm trying to think. Yeah. I mean, she connected everybody through the book, 100%. We had a few women in oral surgery conferences, and they've kind of bounced around, and we haven't had one in a few years, except we just had a almost like a retreat. We went out to Arizona, and there was about 20 of us that met up. And so we're kind of hoping to continue that and help support each other. But it's hard to remember. It's like you just feel like you've known somebody on social media. You don't remember how you met, but then you start talking, and all of a sudden you're friends and sharing.
That's such a beautiful thing, though, you know?
Yeah. There's, like, you know, having kids and social media and stuff, it's a challenging thing to navigate, but I feel like I think there's so much positive with it, especially, I mean, I started using social media, especially when I was in the military, because it was a way for me to connect with family and friends as I was traveling all over the world and share my life and what was going on and not have to repeat the same thing 10 different times. I'd just be like, hey, go look at my Facebook post. It's all right there. You see what the kids are doing. Stop asking me.
That's a good point. That's really funny. Oh, that's so funny. And then you develop these relationships and these friendships. And then you connect on a professional basis. So you had the retreat in Arizona.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's still be a part two to Behind the Scalpel?
Yes, we're going to continue it.
Yes. All right. What is there, like, a projected date or?
So we just had it 2 weeks ago, and we liked kind of this time of the year. So once you're kind of in private practice, I'm not sure about academics, kind of goes with academic scheduling kind of a stuff. But in private practice, you have these ebbs and flows. So you get really busy when kids are out of school. So, summers, your spring breaks, fall breaks, stuff like that. And then you have these periods where things really slow down. So times when it really slows down is when kids go back to school. So September, oral surgery, private practice slows down. And it slows down January, kind of February.
Yeah.
As people, you know, start their new dental insurances, you know, they just had a big holiday. They don't want to spend money. And then April, it slows down again. So we were trying to find a time period when our practices were slow or that we knew we would be able to leave, you know, for a few days.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And then what are, I don't know if it's like an insider thing, what are some of the things you discuss, the challenges that you like to talk solutions, you know, talk job about?
Yeah. One of the things we talked about was how to be a better practitioner, you know, what we can learn from each other, what we can learn from mistakes, we can learn how it's worked for us. One oral surgeon shared kind of how social media has helped her private practice. Another kind of shared some personal events with, like, overcoming imposter syndrome, how to navigate personnel issues with the high turnover in staffing. And, you know, and then we talk about clinical stuff. We talk about all in four implants and which kind of, you know, laser or what kind of printer you want to use, or, you know, some of it's clinical, some of it's clinical, but more personal, I guess.
Have you heard of, like, those mastermind groups where they kind of go into, whether it be business development or practice, scaling the practice, or?
I mean, yeah, we did have a few business kind of discussions, you know, how to run a business, what are some different ways. Some of the consulting firms, one of the consulting firms came in, spoke to us about that, about, like, what they could do to help the practice.
I was going to say, because it sounds like that where it's giving within women in OMFS, it's giving that access to each other to kind of find those opportunities and that insight that this is a hack that I found to this. This is a secret I found with this, like you were saying, like, which maybe implant system that you're using, or the, what is it, the 3D machine thing, like, whatever, little tips and tricks. And I really like that, because then it empowers someone through maybe a different form, you know, a different presentation of that topic. That's great.
Yeah. I mean, I know we didn't specifically talk about it in the experiences this year, but one of the things we kind of were talking about in kind of small groups as we were enjoying ourselves at the spa was how we would love to discuss more contract negotiation. Talk about, you know, how much do you get offered? Do you negotiate maternity leave? Do you negotiate, you know, whatever the issues might be? How do you go about doing that? What are people seeing? How are, another big one, restrictive covenants.
Mm-hmm.
Found out the hard way Knoxville is enforcing. They enforce the restrictive covenant. But, you know, stuff like that, that's beneficial. Health and wellness, geez, you know, even things as running a practice and taking care of kids and aging parents and all that life has to throw at you.
There's so much stuff. I have a friend now who the guy I used for my contract for those negotiations. And,
yeah,
you know, as dentists, surgeons, doctors, however you want to put it, there's so many things in that contract that just look like English to us, you know, and we rush right over it. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. It says dentistry here. You need to change that to oral surgery. And otherwise you can't do anything for 2 years. And these little things. And then getting that access, that's a really good point that you made. The contract negotiation for women is definitely going to be different for men if you're going to take maternity leave. That's going to be, sure, there's paternity leave, but that doesn't. That's very different.
Is it paid maternity leave? Is it unpaid? Is it count towards your PTO? Does it, you know, all the different things, you know, if you have a complicated pregnancy. I had a complicated pregnancy and it was hard to figure out all those ins and outs. And, you know, what if you have an early delivery? You know, I think men should also negotiate paternity leave. I mean, and I think it should be for however you have a child, whether it's adoption, you know, give birth to your own children, mother, father, whatever. I think that's important for the child. And I think it's important in pregnancy, you know, in order to have healthy babies, you have to have a healthy pregnancy, which means making sure you're taking care of yourself and eating and resting and being able to go to doctor's appointments and things.
Well, absolutely. I can't imagine the sacrifices we have to make through residency, you know, both men and women. And then imagine having, as a woman with a baby inside you, to have to make sacrifices. That's probably not going to go well.
Yeah.
If I was to imagine that correctly. Yeah. Man, that's such, the paternity leave. I didn't even think about that on my contract. That's a good idea.
Yeah. It's all the things that a lot of us have learned the hard way too, you know? And it used to be this mind frame, and I had this for a while when I finished my program that, well, I had it this way and it was hard and everybody else should have to suffer the way I did. And it took me a while to realize, no, that's not the right way to do it. I should work to make things better for other people. And just because I had it hard or just because this was done to me doesn't mean it was right. And so I try to mentor and I try to help other people and say, hey, and then when I point out problems, this is another thing. I like to try to give a solution. I don't like to be the person like, this is wrong. This shouldn't do this. I like to say, hey, what about this alternative because of this?
Right. So few people want to do that. You know what I'm talking. It's like an if you know, you know thing. You're either a solutions person or you're just strictly complaining, you know?
And
it's
like, give a good solution to it if you're going to complain. Yeah.
Bring something to the table. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so important, you know, and I appreciate you giving me that insight to the women of OMFS, the symposium. You know, you guys are writing books. You're having the retreats. This access and giving others. It's have you ever seen that? It's like a diagram of steps of, and it's like of life. And then there's one figure reaching down to the person on the lower step to help them come up. And
I
think that's why I make social media and to podcast, connect with people, but also, you know, let's share some insight to the next generation coming up. Let's show them the rights, the wrongs. Let's share with them foresighted thinkingness to show them that all the problems we're talking about with the hospital these days, the losing the instruments, you're transferring a patient 50 miles away to keep it within the system when it's like they're in critical care, they're intubated. But for the future, I think it's great. I think it's great. And I love that you're empowering others through those measures.
Yeah. We rise by lifting others.
That's right. That's right. Well, Dr. Eisenberg, thank you so much for coming on. This is a good time. I appreciate our chat, you know?
Me too. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, you have a good night. We'll keep in touch. The apps.
That's right. Sounds good.
Have a good night.
Good chatting with you.